DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology. I'm Chapona Chimbelu. On today's show, we'll hear about a new technology scientists are working on to keep planes in the air even after a volcano has erupted.
All aircraft these days carry a weather radar which can see thunderstorms and avoid clouds and avoid turbulence as much as they can. So if you had such a system on board an aircraft today, then it's able to take evasive action. It can see there's a problem and then steer around it. And it doesn't have to steer, make very sharp turns. It can just make small adjustments to its course and then avoid the ash cloud.
And in the second of a two-part series on code breakers, we'll head to London to get an insight into the work of today's cybersecurity experts.
These days, we see about 200,000 unique samples every day. It's that sort of volume. And in order to respond to that, you can't rely on reactive technologies. So much more we've had to develop over the last few years, technologies which are really designed to be able to identify stuff based on its behavior. And that's really the area that we're in.
All that and more right here on Spectrum. On Sunday, it was reported that Germany's justice minister is calling for an international treaty on data protection. Her reaction is just one of many related to recent revelations that US Secret Services have been carrying out an extensive online surveillance program. It goes without saying that data protection is a hot topic in several countries right now, even in a country like Kenya. Even though most of the emphasis in recent years has been on the positive effects of the internet and mobile technology, data protection and privacy are now on the radar. Coming under scrutiny is M-Pesa, a mobile banking payment system, which is one of the country's most well-known technologies. Despite being praised for bringing banking to the poor by allowing them to save and transfer money using mobile phones, the service brings up some problems concerning data protection. I spoke with Grace Kitaiga, an associate at the Kenya ICT Action Network, about some of the issues that have been brought about as a result of the widespread use of M-Pesa.
I think one of the privacy issues arising out of M-Pesa is the whole question of protection of data. For you to be able to withdraw or to use the M-Pesa platform, you must register your details. So they want your identity card number, they want your address, sometimes even physical address. So when you transact, whichever transaction you undertake, whether it's withdrawal or depositing of money, those details are left with the M-Pesa agent. And usually the details are recorded in an open book.
Where is a lot of this information stored? Is it stored electronically as well, or is it just on paper?
When you transact with an M-Pesa agent, the information is stored on paper. So it's a hard copy. But what is not clear is whether the data is then returned to the service provider. It is not clear what that data is used for. Yeah, but I also wanted to say, for example, the second issue of privacy that has arisen out of use of M-Pesa is, for example, when spouses are cheating on one another.
Yeah, I just wanted you to go into that, like how it works. If someone is cheating or if there's some sort of weird communication going between two different people.
Yeah, so for example, one of the creativity that has emerged out of that is that if you receive a call from abroad, sometimes it doesn't show where it is coming from. So it just registered on the screen that this is a private number or unknown. And so what people are doing is that when they're cheating their spouses, they store the numbers of their spouses with the name unknown, or they give the name of their spouses as a private number. And so spouses, you know, when they start suspecting each other and they see that there is this private number that keeps calling or is being called, what they do is they will just send the minimum M-Pesa amount, say 50 shillings, which is less than a dollar. They will send to that number. And once you send that money into that account, then it sends you back a report, you know, to tell you that money has been sent to so-and-so. This is their number. You know how much money you have sent and what is your balance right now after sending. And so that, you know, you get to know who this person is.
So basically M-Pesa is a way of identifying someone.
Precisely. Now, the person who receives the money, actually, their privacy is intruded because they have no right to reject this money. And now their details have been revealed to a party that they are not concerned with, to a party that they don't know about. Yeah.
And what are some of the solutions that M-Pesa is trying to come up with to combat some of these issues surrounding privacy?
It's really not clear, but we know that there are issues that are, you know, this is being debated, but so far nothing has changed, so that still remains.
What about Kenyans? What are they doing to try to, basically, if I want to maintain my privacy, I'd have to do something against it. What would you say to a Kenyan? What should they do? How should they use M-Pesa in order to, well, in a good way, but not at the same time infringe on their own privacy?
Unfortunately, that is the situation now. So the much that Kenyans can do is just complain. However, we actually have a data protection bill. I forget whether it's already a bill or it hasn't become law yet. But, you know, that tells you that there is debate around data protection. And some of these things are going to be raised in that bill.
That was Grace Gitaiga from the Kenya ICT Action Network, speaking about mobile payment banking system M-Pesa and data protection in Kenya. It's summer and high season for holidays in Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people are flying. And so far, weather conditions have been cooperating. Temperatures have reached record highs. The last thing on the minds of travelers right now might be conditions disrupting their holiday plans. But this is something on the minds of some scientists. Just over 3 years ago, a volcanic eruption in Iceland caused several European airports to shut down operations because of the resulting ash clouds. Now, because another eruption could take place anytime, researchers are working on technologies that could protect airlines and passengers from another ash cloud crisis. Ashley Byrne met up with one of them.
In 2010, flights were grounded in Europe for 6 days as the result of ash coming from a volcano that erupted in Iceland. Some 10,000 flights were cancelled, leaving 10 million passengers stranded. Experts feared that the ash particles could interfere with the engines, as Dr. Fred Prater, a senior scientist at the Norwegian Institute for Air Research, explains.
The main problem with ash is that once it gets into the hot parts of a jet turbine engine, it melts. When they melt, they fuse onto sensitive parts of the engine, they'll block air cooling vents, and eventually you have what's called a flame out. The engine stalls, it sort of stutters. You get some flames coming out of it, and then the engine will shut down. And, of course, if you lose an engine, and in some cases there have been incidents where they've lost 4 engines in one case, of course it makes it very vulnerable, and the aircraft can have big problems.
That's why volcanologists in Iceland are working on improving methods for monitoring volcanoes and detecting when they will erupt. Freystein Sigmundsson is from the University of Iceland.
In Iceland, there are over 30 volcanoes. And now today, we have more than 100 monitoring instruments on these volcanoes. We have over 50 seismometers in Iceland that are detecting small earthquakes in the roots of these volcanoes. We have GPS geodetic instruments that are detecting the movements if there is inflation of a volcano. There are several volcanoes in Iceland that can erupt with short warning time now, and this includes Hekla and Katla, where the warning tone would be related to the fact that the magma needs to travel the last few kilometers up to the surface of the Earth, and that can be on the scale of 1 or 2 hours.
Satellite observation maps have been used to work out where the ash is once it's in the air, but this process isn't accurate enough in predicting where it might be a few hours later. Dr. Prater at the Norwegian Institute for Air Research is working on forecasting where the ash will travel once it's in the air.
All aircraft these days carry a weather radar, which can see thunderstorms and avoid clouds and avoid turbulence as much as they can. So if you had such a system on board an aircraft today, then it's able to take evasive action. It can see there's a problem and then steer around it. And it doesn't have to steer, make very sharp turns. It can just make small adjustments to its course and then avoid the ash cloud. In combination with that, the system itself can observe the ash cloud and send that information back to a forecasting model. So it's not a system which would act on its own, but it acts in concert with all these other systems.
The system is rather appropriately called a VOID. And in the lab, Dr. Prater has been explaining to us how it works.
We have two of the cameras which will be mounted inside the VOID instrument. So the VOID instrument measures thermal radiation, it measures temperatures. So they're cameras, but they're not like normal digital cameras. They actually measure temperatures, thermal energy. Everything in the atmosphere emits some temperature. And we use two cameras because these two cameras are tuned to the emissions that come from silicate ash particles in the atmosphere. So they're designed specially to pick up the signals from ash.
The technology has been successfully tested on Saharan dust clouds, and there is every confidence it will work. Dr. Prater has set up a company called Nikanika Aviation to commercialise the system, and he's working with Airbus and EasyJet to test it out. A ton of ash from the last eruption in 2010 in Iceland has already been collected and will be used in an airborne examination of the imaging system on board a plane.
That ash is going to be pushed into the atmosphere, essentially using the pressure difference between the inside of the aircraft and the outside. It'll be about several kilometres by several kilometres. So in fact, we think we'll see it from space. It's only 1,000 kilograms. So it represents absolutely no threat in the region that we're going to put it into over the ocean. And we have the perfect controlled experiment. Once we've made our cloud, another aircraft, an A340 with the VOID instrument on board, will fly at it, imaging it from various distances to show that we can detect it against everything else.
But the tests will take time, so there's a real fear among Dr. Prater and his colleagues that the technology they're working on might not be certified in enough time to deal with the next eruption, which could strike at any time. Ashley Byrne, DW.
You're listening to Spectrum with me, Chapana Chambelu, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can follow us on Twitter at dw_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Last week, we heard about how history is being used in the UK to encourage schoolchildren to take up coding. Joanna Impey accompanied a group of schoolgirls who learned about the significance of code breaking during World War II at Bletchley Park. In the second of this two-part series, Joanna Impey is in London to look at the work that is occupying modern-day codebreakers. Cybersecurity. It is high on the agenda right now. With societies, businesses, and governments ever more reliant on the internet, we need technologies to ensure that we're protected from malicious software. Here's Joanna Impey with more.
Just over two decades ago, cybersecurity was a fledgling industry, operating on a small scale. Experts would keep their eyes open for potential malware, often with the help of concerned users, and then write a signature for it, a bit like a fingerprint sample in a police database. That signature could then be used to search computers for a match. But those days are long gone.
Shall I pour it for you?
Yeah, that'd be great, thank you.
In a buzzing London cafe, I meet up with David M. of Kaspersky Lab, a leading cybersecurity firm. We grab a cup of tea in between his business meetings. Nowadays, he explains, the world of cybersecurity is very different from 25 years ago.
These days, we see about 200,000 unique samples every day. It's that sort of volume. And in order to respond to that, you can't rely on reactive technologies. So much more we've had to develop over the last few years, technologies which are really designed to be able to identify stuff based on its behaviour, and that's really the area that we're in. So it's understanding the behaviour and monitoring what software is doing and being able to decide what's anomalous from what is known to be good.
Today's codebreakers still need to be interested in puzzles, patterns and mathematical challenges, but they also need to have a strong ethical drive. They're more in the business of developing preventative strategies than with actual codebreaking.
We need to know at any time that somebody working on this stuff isn't going to be sort of drawn into, if you like, the dark side, for want of a better term.
The recent NSA scandal in the United States has also put cybersecurity in the headlines. Some people are now asking themselves what they can do to prevent governments from reading their emails or tracking the sites they visit online. David M.
We are more than ever dependent on the internet. And I think, you know, that doesn't just go for individuals banking online or shopping online or socializing online, but actually at the level of commerce. The internet is now the lifeblood of business, and governments too are dependent on it. So we are more, as a society, I think, more and more dependent on the internet. Now, that's great, but it does mean that it provides more exposure, more points of contact at which somebody can try to interfere with those internet-based services. And it could be to steal secrets. It could be to steal information that can be sold on the black market. It could be to try and extort money. But it could just as easily be social or political protest.
But how to prevent such malicious activity? Our own governments have huge concerns about the threat posed by hackers and cyber terrorists.
You know, that's one of the reasons the government, our government and other governments, are really keen to engage with business, because what we would call critical infrastructure, and we're talking about power plants, water, sewerage, car production, anything really these days which is industrialised tends to be computerised, that government doesn't have control over those, but actually they can have interruption of such industries can have a big impact on all citizens, and they're keen to engage with them to make sure that awareness of the potential dangers is there and that people are taking mitigating actions.
One country that's leading the way in this field is Finland, which is home to many of the world's top cybersecurity companies. Jano Limnell works for Stonesoft, an IT firm in the Finnish capital. He says the success is down to public-private partnerships.
Finland is very strongly technologically orientated country, and people are used to use technology. We have many, many small companies with excellent innovations in the field of the technology, and when those companies cooperate closely with the government, I think that gives us a great advantage.
Indeed, Finland's good reputation in this field has attracted international attention.
That is something that many nations, also United Kingdom, some authorities and officials from the United Kingdom has every now and then come here to see how we have tackled these problems and how these models for this cooperation has been organized.
So modern-day codebreakers have to look to one another to develop new expertise. Given that the internet is a global phenomenon, tackling cybercrime and cyberterrorism also involves international effort. No doubt the recent headlines about threats in cyberspace will also raise awareness and potentially inspire more young people to become modern-day codebreakers. Joanna Rimpey, DW, London.
Imagine a city where you don't have to look for a parking space because your smartphone tells you where there's free parking spaces. And garbage collectors come to empty the trash when it's full because the bins send messages to tell city workers they need to be emptied. It may sound like sci-fi, but there's four cities in Europe where such systems are being tested. One of them is the old port city of Santander in Spain. It has emerged as a prototype for high-tech, smart cities worldwide. The city of Santander is blanketed with sensors that measure everything from air pollution to where there are free parking spaces. Lauren Freyer traveled to Santander to investigate how the city's administrators have managed to pull this off.
Atlantic waves crash into Santander's seawall. Aside from the occasional ferry from England, this northern Spanish town doesn't get too many foreign visitors. So you can imagine the turned heads when delegations from Google, Microsoft, and the Japanese government all landed here recently to literally walk these streets. What they've been coming to see, though, is mostly invisible. 12,000 sensors buried under the asphalt, affixed to street lamps and atop city buses. They silently survey parking availability and whether surf's up at local beaches. They can even tell garbage collectors which dumpsters are full and automatically dim streetlights when no one's around. The sensors were paid for by a 9 million euro EU grant to Professor Luis Munoz at the University of Cantabria.
You see here the two antennas, you see, just behind the tree. So those antennas are gathering the information coming from the sensors under the ground and sent towards the command and control center. It's well integrated, it's seamless.
Santander is one of four cities in the UK, Germany and Serbia where sensors are being tested. But with about 180,000 residents, Santander is small enough to really saturate with these devices. So it's become Europe's prime testing ground for expanding this technology elsewhere on the continent. Munoz drives around downtown Santander, pointing out sensors and digital panels that display the number of available parking spots on every street.
Once a car parks on top of the magnetic sensor, the magnetic field changes. This is detected by the sensor, and then we update the information in the database, and then this is depicted in the panel. So this is the way that the thing works. Okay.
The sensors send data to a command and control center and also to a suite of applications on citizen smartphones. Real-time information on road closures, parking availability, bus delays, or the pollen count. And citizens can contribute too. By taking a smartphone photo of a pothole or broken streetlight, for example, and uploading it directly to City Hall. There's an app for that. Mayor Íñigo de la Serna rattles off the list of big corporations his once sleepy city is now doing business with.
We have signed agreements with NEC from Japan, with Ferrovial, like a service company, with Telefonica, of course, with IBM for the Santander City Brain, with the Bank of Santander for new kind of payment devices.
The mayor pulls out his iPad and demonstrates the Santander City Brain, an app where he floats ideas and citizens can weigh in.
So, you know, the ideas platform of the...
Yeah.
So, people has already sent us about 400 different ideas. Very, very interesting. So the citizen is like sitting with us, telling, I want to work to make this city better. I don't want only just to complain, you know.
These days, Spanish streets erupt often in angry protests over the economy. But Santander has managed to buck the trend. People are using their smartphones to make their city better. The city saves money, about 25% on electricity bills and 20% on garbage. And utility companies pick up the tab for the sensors' upkeep because they save money by using them. Retailers seem to like it too.
Hola, buenas.
My name is Angel Benito, Angel Benito. This is a family business. I'm 9038, 75 years old this year.
Benito's shoe store has a smart Santander sticker in the front window, and he's received orders through smartphones even when his shop is closed.
This is an old city. We are all shops, but we are on it. We are in the latest technologies. We have to do it. Because when you are in crisis, you really need to know what can we do and do it. Just not think about it, just do it and go ahead.
But with all this data buzzing around, I had one question about privacy. So I did a little experiment. It's a breezy morning in Santander and I'm having a coffee under an olive tree in the Plaza de Pombo. I've downloaded the Smart Santander apps for Android, and as I hold up my phone to the square, icons pop up on the screen, telling me there's a construction zone to my right, and there's a sporting goods store to my left, which has a sale going on, and the store opens in about 35 minutes. Pretty handy. An hour later, I'm inside Santander's command and control center, asking,
could you see me?
No. We don't register the users. What we know is
a user from a language is using this application.
You saw someone who speaks English was in...
This is the information that you can get, but it's the same that people do with the websites.
IT researcher Veronica Gutierrez mans a huge digital map of the city overlaid with coordinates for every smartphone user.
So those are the people in the city who are using right now?
Yeah, in the last 24 hours. But when we present this application in the Mobile World Congress, we saw that people were using the application in the States. Sometimes you get surprised where people is using this.
Over at the offices of Santander's biggest newspaper, El Diario Montañés, Emilio Martinez is the webmaster. He's 34, by all accounts a techie, but he's not on Facebook. He thinks it's Big Brother. But he doesn't have a problem sharing data with his neighbors. That's what cities are all about, he says.
In Santander, everyone knows everyone. I think that behind Facebook, a commercial purpose behind that. Here, no. Here is useful data, useful services to the citizens. It's different. I think that if you offer something useful to the citizens, this is the best you can do.
Bankrupt Spain may actually be fertile ground for smart cities like this. While Spaniards earn less than the European average income, they've got about a third more smartphones. The mayor of Santander is now the president of the Smart Cities Network in Spain. His next project? Wireless water and electricity meters for homes and businesses. Lauren Freyer, DW, Santander, Spain.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science and listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Chapana Chimbelu. Our studio technician was Ksenia Denchik. Next week, we'll get to hear about how iPads are being used in schools in the Netherlands. Hope you can make it then. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
Lass uns zum Strand, du weißt, welchen ich mein. Ich brauch mal wieder Meer und Sand, yeah. Brauch mal wieder einen Grund zu bleiben. Ei, deine Uhr fällt ins Blau. Wir sehen, wie die Zeit versinkt. Wir setzen langsam auf. Das Wasser spiegelt glatt und blinkt. Wir wollen die Sehnsucht nach morgen, weil es heute perfekt ist. Sehnsucht nach morgen, weil es heute perfekt ist. Du stehst neben mir, zeigst mir, dass es echt ist. Die Lichter meiner Stadt sind verbrannt. Lass uns zum Strand. Zum Strand, komm, wir steigen aus. Du leuchtest wie aus Diamant, yeah, mit all dem Salz auf der Haut. Hey, ich seh dich gestochen scharf. Es tut fast den Augen weh. Und endlich bist du da. So hab ich dich noch nie gesehen, yeah. Wir wollen die Sehnsucht nach morgen, weil es heute perfekt ist. Sehnsucht nach morgen, weil es heute perfekt ist. Du stehst neben mir, zeigst mir, dass es echt ist. Die Lichter meiner Stadt sind verbrannt. Lass uns zum Strand.